So at the end of the last session, I mentioned the three levels of knowledge that we need to cultivate on the path. That the final knowledge, the true path, is the direct realization of the ultimate nature of things, of emptiness. So when we say direct realization, we're talking about the six types of consciousness. It's clear the mental consciousness that we meditate with. It's none of the five sense consciousnesses, because actually, as one gains concentration, the sense consciousnesses stop functioning. The entire energy of the mind is the mental consciousness. So when you have single point of concentration, actually the sounds and the sights and the pains stop at last. But and so we're meditating with mental consciousness. And so knowledge is clearly an aspect of mental consciousness. And it's quite logical the way it is presented, that first we cultivate the knowledge of hearing information, like being taught or reading it, and comparing it with our own experience, and then we analyze the deeper meaning of what we learned, and then finally we meditate on that deeper meaning and gain the direct realization. So those are the three types of knowledge. And there are the objects of knowledge. Because knowledge is subjective, and then what we know are the objects. So Buddha classified objects of knowledge into two: things which are apparent to our senses and things which are hidden from our senses. So it's clear that there are eyes, ears, smell, taste, touch. We gain knowledge of the sensory world. But then there are things which are not immediately obvious to our sense consciousnesses, and these are divided into hidden objects. Some are slightly hidden, some are deeply hidden from our mind. It's not that they can't be known. And Buddhism says, if something exists, then it's knowable. It can be known by mind. Ultimately, of course, the mind is perfected in the attainment of Buddhahood. So the Dharmakaya, wisdom mind of a Buddha, is said to be omniscient. It knows whatever there is to be known. So slightly hidden things are things like subtle impermanence, the subtle moment-by-moment change, which we've already talked about in the classification of phenomena, that there are changeable things, subject to subtle impermanence, and non-changing things, like space, emptiness, and so on. So gross change, like the burning down of a house or, you know, death, that's not the subtle impermanence. The subtle is this moment-by-moment change. So that can only be realized through mental consciousness, through the power of meditation. First, we understand subtle impermanence and emptiness too. Emptiness is known intellectually first, and then directly. Very hidden things, said to be like the very subtle functions of karma, is like everything. For each individual, our whole life is the unfolding of our karmic past. It's the result of our past actions. And there are examples when Shariputra, one of the Buddha's disciples, had great awareness, but there were subtle karmic causes which even Shariputra, who was an arhat, could not perceive. So Buddha's omniscient, or the power of Buddha's wisdom, was able to see far, far back, like the story of the fly on the piece of dried up elephant dung that went around a stupa, and that created in the fly's mind the karmic condition to be able to become a monk. Whereas Shariputra, to this poor old man, no, you have no cause to become ordained, and wouldn't let him into the monastery. The Buddha said, yes, there is a cause. And that was that very subtle thing. So, that's objects of knowledge. So, did you receive the second lot of notes about the main minds and mental factors? You have that? It came out? So, you've probably... This information comes from the topic of low rig, mind and awareness. And I'm not going to go into it in great detail, but I think it's really useful to... Our subject for this weekend is understanding the mind. And so we've talked about the six main types of consciousness, the five sense consciousnesses and mental consciousness. Now, that's a general view of the mind. Now, in more detail. So those six primary or main types of consciousness, then they see the object, when we are aware of an object, they see just the general entity, if you like, of the object. But that's not all that our mind in general is aware of. The mind is aware of more specific aspects of the objects. And this presentation of the 51 mental factors, it's almost, and it's not artificial, but it's a breaking up of one general moment of awareness into particular aspects so that we can understand how the mind functions. That's really useful when we think about it. So it's not that the mental factors are a different type of thing from the main consciousness. They're aspects of the main consciousness. You know, they have the same object, and they occur at the same time, and they're of the same nature as the main mind. But they can be distinguished. And in this process of distinguishing one from the other, we learn so much about mind. This is real Buddhist psychology. And it's something which we can immediately identify with. In the history of psychology, there are many structures of mind which introduce new terms and new concepts and really hard to follow. This is so simple. Actually, the first psychologist to introduce a reasonable structure of mind was Sigmund Freud, the Viennese doctor at the beginning of last century. And I have incredible admiration for Sigmund Freud, for what he, the way he put down his observations in exploring the mind and put down a simple structure. We won't go into that, but there is a book I've written called The World and Ourselves, Buddhist Psychology. And hopefully, ABC will publish that in a month or two. So you can read all about it in that as a free book. So, the presentation of the 51 mental factors begins with five ever-present mental factors. These are ever-present, meaning that these five, these necessarily occur with every experience of mind, whether it's a sensory experience, your sense consciousness, or a mental consciousness. There are always these five aspects are manifesting. So in the notes, I think feeling is the first one that's there. So feeling, in the Buddhist context, doesn't mean what in general, when we talk about feelings, that sort of word covers all of our emotions and so on. But specifically, in the Buddhist context, the term feeling refers to mental consciousness having happiness or unhappiness or neutral feeling, or sense consciousness feeling pleasure, pain, or indifference, neutral experience. So every object that mind experiences is experienced in a pleasant way, or the object has a pleasant appearance, or unpleasant appearance, or neutral. And feeling is the very experience of pleasure, displeasure, or neutral feeling. In the notes it says the general function of feeling is to experience the ripening effects of past actions. Karma, right? Action means karma. So this means that every happy feeling, every pleasant feeling, is the ripening effect of past actions, virtuous actions. Every unhappy feeling, every unpleasant sensory experience, is a ripening effect of non-virtuous karma. And every neutral feeling is the ripening of neutral karma. So, when we think about this, we realize what a vast effect our karma has on our lives. We're all equally seeking pleasure. We're all equally trying to be free from pain. But we're totally unaware that if we haven't created the karmic cause in the past, no matter how hard we try, we can't experience the pleasure we want. And if we've created the cause for displeasure, pain, no matter how hard we try to avoid it, the ripening of karma, we can't stop, unless we know how to purify karma. That's something else. But you see, we're all, most of us, totally unaware of the karmic causality behind our whole life. Pleasant, unhappy, pleasant feelings. And we're convinced that no, the real source of pleasure is out there. There are beautiful objects to taste, touch, see, hear. You know, we pay lots of money to go to the music concert and the art galleries and so on, and buy expensive, nice-looking clothes, etc. There's the pleasure in the shop. All I have to do is get the money and I can buy pleasure. But even if you've got the money, if you don't have the karma, you can't get what you want. I presume in Singapore you have the lottery where you choose the numbers. Many, many, many years ago I went to Lama Zopa in Australia and I asked him if he could give me six numbers under 45. So he, yes. He throws his dice and gives me the six numbers. So I'm walking out of the room expecting to win hundreds of thousands of dollars. And just as I was about to close the door, he looked up and said, you also have to have the karma. I didn't. So, that's the reality, which most people are unaware of. So feeling, really important. The second mental factor, which always occurs in every moment of consciousness, we call a discrimination or recognition. Discrimination is that part of our mind which distinguishes the particular features of an object. It distinguishes it's this and not that, and it's good, bad, or whatever. Discrimination, it knows more about the particular object. It's aware. It's not a type of knowledge. You know, knowledge is a mental factor which comes in the next group. It's just a type of awareness able to distinguish this from that. Now, actually, when in your past teachings, you've all heard of the five aggregates, right? The five collections, the human body and mind. Buddha described them in five groups. There's the first is the body itself, the form aggregate. Then there's a feeling aggregate. And that's this mental factor of feeling. Then there's the discrimination aggregate or recognition aggregate. That's this one. Then there's the aggregate of volitions, which is all the rest. All the remaining mental factors, virtuous and non-virtuous, plus those objects that I talked about yesterday, which are neither mind nor form. They're all included in the fourth aggregate of discriminations. And the fifth aggregate is the consciousness aggregate. So that's the five, that's the six main types of consciousness. So the five aggregates is this is a more expanded presentation of the five aggregates. Now why did Buddha select feelings and discriminations as separate, like aggregates in their own right? It's explained in the Abhidhamma. The Buddha presented the aggregate of feelings, happiness, unhappiness, etc. Very important. Because feelings are the basis of dispute amongst most people. Right? We fight each other to get what we want, to give us pleasure, and to not get what we don't want. So the pursuit of pleasant feelings and avoiding unpleasant feelings, which we all believe are out there, you know, the causes out there. This is the basis of so much fighting in families, groups, between nations. Just acquisition, greed, power, and so on. And discriminations, they are the basis of dispute among scholars. Scholars who are competing with each other to present reality. There's so much in our history of fighting between, from a political standpoint, a philosophical standpoint, or a scientific standpoint, or a religious standpoint. People say, my way is best. And there's so much dispute among scholars. So that's why Buddha chose these two mental factors, feelings and discriminations, as separate aggregates. They're all part of mind, but these are important ones because of what they do in society. The third one is, that's even more important. The third is the mental factor of intention. Now, intention is, as it implies, the intention is like interest or an impulse in the mind which leads the general mind to engage with a particular object. There is a movement in our mind which connects the mind through the body, right, with particular objects. And we an illustration would be there's a, I don't know, $50 note on the ground. No people are walking on the footpath. And so many people just don't see it. But then somebody comes along and their mind is attracted. They see it. That's karma. And that happened to me when I was about 5 years old. And I was going to school in Sydney, Australia. And I had to catch the tram to the school. So our family lived in a flat, an apartment in Bondi. So I walked. There'd been a lot of rain overnight. I can remember so distinctly. I walked to the tram stop, a lot of people there. And in the gutter, there was a £1 note. This is before the dollars in Australia. And a pound note in the 1940s was a lot of money in Australia. I ran home, Mum, look, I found a quid. That was the slang term for a pound, is a quid. So it wasn't chance, it wasn't an accident that my eyes connected with this money in the gutter. And it's the same. Everything we do, we have intentions. Like we can think about, what am I going to do today? I'll do such and such a thing. That is an intention. But in a more subtle way, there are intentions connecting our mind with things which we're not aware of. And that, those intentions are karmic ripenings. How, you see, when we create a karmic potential on our mind stream, remember, I'm sure you've had teachings on karma, in fact we'll get it next week or the week after. There are four branches in creating a karmic potential in the mind. And one is intention, the purpose behind the act. So then, that whatever happens, virtuous or non-virtuous, but the potency of that action remains as a karmic seed or potential on the mind stream. So how does it ripen? How does the non-virtuous potential ripen to connect this mind with a pleasant or an unpleasant experience, whether it's virtuous or non-virtuous? It gives rise to intention. Intention. In this context, there are other intentions which are cultivated, but in the context of karmic ripening, karmic seeds connect the mind stream with the result of actions through generating an intention which moves the mind towards a particular object, a pleasant object or an unpleasant object. So this third one, it's happening all the time. So why our everything unfolding in our life is our karma. And that's, how is it connected? Through intention. Then contact is the fourth of these ever-present. So clearly, when the intention arises, there's contact with the mind, with the visual object, auditory, smell, taste, touch, or a thought, even an object of thought. So that contact refers to the initial experience of the object. So contact precedes feeling. That they don't occur in the order that they're given here. First, actually, there's intention. Then there's contact. Then there's feeling. Then the fifth one is mental, called, literally mental engagement or attention. So, following upon the initial intention, which connected us to the object in general, then engagement means that the mind focuses upon or engages on specific details of the object. So, I guess the sequence is intention, contact, feeling, engagement, and discrimination. Yeah, discrimination probably. Anyway, I don't know about the sequence, but you can see how actually all five are operating simultaneously. And that's whether the object is of a thought, an object of thought in mental consciousness, or the object of senses. So those are the five ever-present mental factors. It's really good. And as I said at the beginning, this understanding of these doesn't require learning someone's intellectual framework to explain psychology. It's so straightforward. And it is of our own experience, and we can think about it and check up, and we could recognize. So that's the first group. The second group, these five also occur all the time. But Buddha, in teaching these, is now going into even more detail. When we're experiencing a particular object, it's a bit of a mouthful, the object ascertaining mental factors. So it just means these are aspects of the mind which really get to know the object in more detail, ascertain to know the object in detail. And again, if we check up in our own experience, we can identify them. So the first is called aspiration. Now, we can have the intention to get to know virtuous objects or non-virtuous objects. You know, we might decide we want to rob the bank over the road. So we have a lot of thinking and planning of how to rob the bank. So it's these five could be spoken about in terms of the thought process of wanting to rob a bank. But specifically, we're not talking about non-virtuous objects. These five are presented by Buddha in relationship to virtuous objects, which are much better to concentrate on than non-virtuous, robbing banks or something. So the object in this context is virtuous. So aspiration, or the wish, seeks a virtuous object, right? In particular, of meditation or of our Dharma practice, with interest and faith that it is worthwhile to get to know this virtuous object, particularly an object of meditation. And to hold it. Once I can find it, I can hold it, so not separate from it. So, as it says, in seeking Dharma realizations based on faith, aspiration is the basis for the virtuous mental factor of enthusiasm. And enthusiasm makes the mind pliant, flexible, and overcomes laziness. So, aspiration is really, you know, we all are told by our lamas that it's good to meditate every day. And sometimes we might wake up and think, oh, I have to meditate. Lama told me I must meditate. Oh,
I haven't got time.
I must. So really, we sit down, but our aspiration is for the end of the meditation session. It's not to meditate on the breath or to think about impermanence or emptiness or to generate the mind in virtue. We don't have time to generate the mind. We've got to get to work. Right? That's no good. It's a type of aspiration, but in a way it's not virtuous. Virtuous aspiration is think, yes, meditation is so important. And to generate the mind in virtue, this is the best way to prepare for the day. And so we sit down with joy and with eager anticipation to free our mind from selfishness, to think about the kindness of others, and to generate heartwarming love as being my meditative object for the whole day. So that is the aspiration. That is the virtuous aspiration. If we don't do that, even if we sit without moving, we're not meditating. In fact, we're creating negative karma. Our mind is off somewhere else. So important, before we engage in virtue, to really check up our aspiration. And as it says, it comes from faith, confidence in the three jewels, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. Yes, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha are more important than what's on the front page of the newspaper or on the first, on the news, on the television or whatever. These are valid and these are worthwhile. So that's aspiration, this real virtuous. And you can see how the intention, this is a new intention, right? This is a virtuous intention that we cultivate. So it creates a new karma. It will create a virtuous karma. There can be karmic influence also in us deciding I'm going to really meditate properly today. But this virtuous state of mind has been generated in dependence upon our teacher, who introduced us to the three jewels. So you can see how we're getting, it's more complicated, but there is a pattern. There is a clear pattern to identify. And this gives us the instruction of how we can put the Buddha's instructions, our teacher's instructions, into practice. So that's the first of these five object ascertaining mental factors, aspiration. The second is conviction, or strong belief, or interest. So this strong belief, this conviction, stabilizes our mind focused upon the virtuous object, right? So it's stable. We decided to meditate on watching the breath to keep the mind still and quiet. So really believing that this is valid, strong interest, the mental factor of conviction is that stabilized awareness, say, for example, watching our breath. So as the notes say, it stabilizes the mind focused on the aspired object and prevents the mind from being distracted. If we lack conviction, the initial effort of aspiration fades away and we're supposed to be watching our breath, but we're daydreaming. We go off into a fantasy, usually thinking about some object of pleasure. All right? So every time we sit down to meditate, if we're conscious, aspiration, yep, that gets me on the seat. Conviction holds the object. And that clearly leads to the third mental factor in this group, mindfulness. So this is based upon conviction. So as a result of conviction, mindfulness holds the object. It doesn't forget. That's the main thing about mindfulness. It's not forgetting the breath. Why do we drift off? Because we don't have mindfulness. We forget that we're supposed to be watching the breath. That's the lack of memory that is non-mindfulness. Very subtle. It happens to me. I can be reading a book and the eyes can follow the words down to the bottom of the page, but the mind is drifting somewhere else, and I get to the eyes get to the bottom of the page, I haven't a clue what they were looking at. I have to go back again and reread it. So the three qualities of mindfulness are familiarity with the object, not forgetting the object, remaining undistracted. So these three set the mind in meditation. And what's the fourth? Concentration. Tingnesin. Single point of concentration. So this is actually, it comes from the preceding three. It comes from conviction, aspiration, conviction, and mindfulness. So in a way, you could say concentration is perfect mindfulness. The mind is focused on the object with less and less and less effort required to hold the object. Concentration, as the notes say, functions as the basis for acquiring knowledge. Knowledge is the next one. Knowledge is the fifth in this group. So I ended the last talk on the types of knowledge. This is how we develop them, through these five object ascertaining mental factors. We don't really get knowledge until we have good mindfulness, good concentration, and then we know the subject. Everybody who studied for exams and so on, you have to go through this sequence. You've got to make your mind clear, and then you really know the object. It's not going to happen, boom, instantaneously. Now, this is the method for study, whether we're talking about learning a subject at university or learning Dharma. So there's the different types of knowledge, the knowledge of listening, analysis, and meditation that we talked about. All right? So you can see those second five? So good to be aware of them. And they're not esoteric, strange words or strange concepts. They're so straightforward. This is the beauty of Buddhist psychology. It is not theoretical, it is totally practical. Then the next group is the 11 virtuous mental factors. The meaning of virtue in Tibetan Gewa, in general, the meaning of virtue is that which in the short term brings pleasant experiences and brings a desirable or is a desirable karmic result. And in the long term, ultimately, virtue is that quality of mind which protects one from suffering by bringing us to liberation and enlightenment. Non-virtue is the opposite. Non-virtue is mental attitudes that bring about that are unpleasant in their own nature, and they ripen karma for unpleasant experiences. And neutral karma are actions which Buddha didn't classify as virtuous or non-virtuous, just neutral. So there's karma which is neither virtuous nor non-virtuous, still karma. This is an important point. We all have a great accumulation, a vast accumulation of virtuous karmic potentials and non-virtuous karmic potentials. Now, and they're ripening throughout our life, each moment of the day, they're ripening for the experience of pleasant or unpleasant experiences. Now, an important distinction is made here, that if the mind in general is virtuous, one of these or several of these 11 virtuous mental factors is manifesting, that becomes the soil or the cause for the ripening of past virtuous karmic potentials. In other words, if the mind is non-virtuous, if one of the non-virtuous mental factors is manifesting, a virtuous karmic potential cannot ripen. Virtuous karmic potentials can only ripen in a mind that is in general virtuous. And similarly, non-virtuous karmic potentials can only ripen in a mind that in general is non-virtuous. They cannot ripen in a mind that is virtuous. It's so important, because in learning what is a virtuous mental factor and a non-virtuous mental factor, if we train ourselves to maintain a virtuous attitude, and if we have the virtuous karma to get what we want, this is the method. And even if we have non-virtuous karma to experience what we don't want, if we can hold the mind in virtue, that non-virtuous karma cannot ripen. This is the point where we can really take control of our lives by consciously maintaining our minds in virtue and consciously abandoning non-virtue the moment it arises. The moment, it's easy to abandon agitating things like anger, greed, jealousy. We can see that they are awful to experience. We don't feel good. But it's not so easy to abandon longing, desire, attachment, pride. These are more subtle. And in our society, we encourage longing, desire. Yeah, we think, what will I buy for the New Year present for my friends? Oh, something that they're attached to. Yes. And what do I want? Something I'm attached to. Are we really helping each other by feeding each other's desires? Actually, no. But it's cultural, yes, of course. Well, you know, it's good to have the wish to make others happy. But real happiness comes internally, and the material objects are just conditions. So we have to be skillful. Once we make people's minds happy, then we say, now let's all go down to ABC and meditate. Right? Yeah.
needs to be virtuous in order to experience the ripening karma of good karma, right? So then, how is it that people who are so-called bad people, and so then their minds are therefore not virtuous, experience good things?
So the question is, if the mind has to be virtuous for good things to happen, to ripen, how is it that bad people, good things happen to them? Nobody, the ordinary people, nobody's totally good, nobody's totally bad. Our minds fluctuate from virtue to non-virtue to neutral so rapidly. You know, we can be quite peaceful and virtuous, and then we just hear the name of a person we don't like, and we get angry. Oh, I don't talk about that person, you know, just like that. Our virtue is very fragile. You know, desire, the object of desire appears. Out it comes. So, and the same, nobody's totally bad. We're human beings. As I said this morning, to be born human, this is the result. We died in our previous life, we died with such a virtuous mind. A virtuous mind, we faced, however we died, we faced that difficulty with a peaceful, positive mind, and that nurtured the karma to be human beings now. This is definite. It's not chance that we're humans. Which means that we were born from virtue. Yes, we brought with us in our mind all of the seeds of non-virtue, selfishness, anger, pride, attachment, and all the negative karmas. But our life, because we're human, is proof that our life began in a virtuous state. So even then, as we're growing up, we're subjected to all sorts of environmental different things, of misleading friends, good friends, and we get pulled this way and that, virtue, non-virtue, mostly non-virtue. Even those, you know, it's through ignorance. They feel that by feeding our desires, giving us great New Year presents, we'll be really happy. There's not enough knowledge in that affection to make others happy. It's not skillful method. Okay. So when good things happen to apparently bad people, their mind was in virtue when that good happened. It fluctuates. That's all. All right, so the 11 virtuous mental factors. So these mental factors are virtuous from their own side. So whenever one or several of these 11 is manifesting, the entire mental consciousness becomes virtuous. So if we go back to the ever-present mental factors, feeling, discrimination, intention, contact and mental engagement. These are neutral. From their own side, they're neither virtuous nor non-virtuous. But when one of these 11 virtuous mental factors is manifesting, all five are virtuous. Because they are made virtuous in dependence upon the natural virtue of faith, these 11. Or, if the mind is anger or attachment and is non-virtuous, then those five are made non-virtuous by the non-manifest anger or desire or pride in our mind. So the mental consciousness at any one moment of time is either totally virtuous, totally non-virtuous or totally neutral. At any one time, there's not a mixture of manifest virtue and non-virtue or neutral. Is that clear? We do fluctuate moment by moment. A virtuous mind can quickly become non-virtuous. Non-virtuous can become virtuous. But at any one moment in time, the mind is of one colour or one taste. Okay. In general, when the mind is in virtue, it's said to feel smooth. You know, smooth, pleasant, harmonious. Whereas when an affliction is manifest, the mind is agitated, rough, unpleasant. Subjectively, the mind is like that. So the fundamental virtuous mental factor is faith. So the meaning of faith is the mental attitude which appreciates and admires virtuous qualities, you know, love, compassion, generosity, patience, and so on, and admires beings who possess those virtuous qualities. And has the aspiration, so we're going back to mental factor of aspiration, it has the aspiration to attain virtuous qualities. Is it real? Knowledge of what virtue is, I want it. That's not attachment, that's not desire. That is constructive, virtuous attitude of faith. So, as we said, faith is the foundation for those aspiration, conviction, mindfulness that we talked about before. Three types of faith. There's the faith of conviction. So, through listening to the teachings and through contemplating the meaning of the teachings, and we see that they're both logical and they are in accord with our experience. This is so important. For the teachings to be in accord with our experience. You know, Lama Thubten Yeshe, when he first began teaching people from all over the world in the 1970s, his favorite phrase was, check up. Check up, check up, check up. Check up in your own experience whether what I'm saying is valid or not. So by doing that, we gain the faith of conviction. Convictional faith. So the more we listen, study and meditate, the stronger our convictional or believing faith arises in our mind. The second type of faith is admiring faith. So admiring, for example, the good qualities of the three jewels. And good qualities in others, particularly one of our big problems is jealousy. In Dharma practitioners, you become competitive of others, of each other, and jealous of this one being praised by the teacher and me not being praised. I try hard. Teacher pays no attention to me. So admiring faith, it's called clarifying faith. It makes the mind clear. When we're competitive, when we're jealous, envious of others, the mind is cloudy. It's not clear. It's that is non-virtuous state of mind. Aspirational faith is where we contemplate the objects of faith and, you know, the levels of the path, renunciation, bodhicitta, wisdom, realizing emptiness. And we see that they can be attained. I really want to achieve renunciation, bodhicitta, and wisdom, realizing emptiness. So that's the aspiration of I can do it. So many don't have this aspirational faith. Oh, the lamas, the bodhisattvas, they are such great beings. They can do it. I can't do that. I'm just ordinary me. That's wrong view. We all have the Buddha potential, the potential to become enlightened. And aspirational faith is that which sets us on the path. Aspirational faith sets us on the path to meditate, gain mindfulness, and achieve those goals. So we need that at the beginning. We should not put ourselves down. We should not think, I am not capable of doing that. That's wrong. We are capable. We are human beings. We're not rabbits. Rabbits can't do much. Even dogs and cats can't do much. But we're human, and this is so brief, this human life. So short. Every moment is unbelievably full of potential to train the mind while we can. Okay, that's faith. The second might be called conscience or shame. So this is the virtuous state of mind where we refrain, we restrain the mind from engaging in non-virtue through personal disapproval. No, it's wrong for me to kill, to steal, to lie. You know, the impulse might come to steal something or to kill an annoying insect. But no, I've decided against that. I've taken vows, and it would be wrong. I will be breaking my personal ethics if I did that negative action. So we avoid doing it. This happens in life. It can happen in dreams. There have been situations when, in a dream, I've been tempted to do something to break my vows, and I tell myself in the dream, you're a monk, you can't do that. So I don't, even in the dream. Shame, a virtuous mental factor. The next one, consideration or embarrassment. This is similar, that we it is that mental attitude which refrains from engaging in non-virtue through considering the feelings of others. We say, it would be so wrong if my lama was aware that I was to do this action. The lama would be upset. If Buddha, the three jewels, were aware, it would be wrong. Not only that, if we have an impulse to harm somebody through killing, stealing, lying, etc., we consider the feelings of the sentient being that we're going to hurt. And so, no, out of compassion and kindness, I'm not going to do this harmful action. So shame and consideration are the foundations of maintaining the mind in virtue. So important. Then, non-attachment is the opposite of attachment. So, when attachment arises, we see no fault. We, as I say, you know, we feed each other's desires. It's good to indulge in desire for pleasure. But non-attachment sees desire as mistaken. And when desire manifests, non-attachment, no, you're not going to go along that line. You're not going to self-indulge just in pleasure. If it's useful for others, then do it. Right? I remember, again, Lama Yeshe talking to the, in the 1970s, when most of his audience were hippies and so on. Lama Yeshe, he would say, If you go to the party, and you dress up, you put on makeup and beautiful clothes, just out of the desire to be admired, to be the center of attention, to be praised, that is wrong. But a beautiful appearance pleases other people's minds. So if you go to a party and you wear the best clothes, put on makeup, do your hair to look attractive, to please other people's minds, do it. Right? The difference is whether I'm doing it for me or for others. And they even say, oh, you hippies, you think renunciation is eating dal bhat, you know, rice and vegetables, and dal, at the street side restaurants in Kathmandu, and that's renunciation. But that's not renunciation. That is pride and arrogance. Here am I, I'm the great Buddhist practitioner, I'm eating very simple food, look at me. That's not renunciation. So again, you can go to the best restaurant, enjoy the best food, with a purpose of making others happy. So, understanding these, we can we don't have to be afraid of pleasure. What we have to be, pleasure is not a problem. Pleasure is the ripening of virtuous karma. Attachment is the problem. Craving pleasure. Self-centeredness. Look at me. That's the problem. Okay. Non-attachment. Yeah. Non-attachment. Relationship, yeah. Non-attachment in a relationship.
Yeah.
A good relationship, yes. A difficult relationship. Attachment. Of course. There is no... we're coming to attachment. That's one of the root afflictions. Non-attachment is when... answer to your question is best answered when we talk about the affliction of a desire and attachment, all right? A relationship is best when there is no attachment between the individuals. Best. It doesn't mean that you reject the object. Like we've been saying, that the important thing is what we can do to make others happy. So if others are attached to us, well, that's their problem. But we don't just reject them because, oh, I'm the object of your attachment, I must be hurting you, go away. That will cause them to commit suicide. You know, we have to be very skillful. So in our practice of virtue, we have to combine wisdom with love and compassion. And we'll come around to that. Non-anger. So non-anger, again, is that state of mind which recognizes the faults of anger. And deliberately, consciously, keeps the mind calm and patient and not becoming angry. So patience is really, non-anger is patience. That's a virtuous mental quality. And the examples are, training the mind in non-anger is to not blame others when they blame us. So often, if we just, even kindly, we say to somebody, look, you made a mistake, well, you do the same thing. You know, the instant response is putting an attack upon us. People can't accept that they were wrong or made a mistake. So when people point out our faults, whether they were real or not real, still, we don't instantly attack them by putting the thing back upon them. If others strike us, we don't strike back. Restrain that. If others are angry at us, we don't get angry in response. It only makes it worse. Anger has no place. If others criticize us, we don't criticize them in return. Non-anger, keeping the mind calm. Non-confusion. So non-confusion is a state of clarity of mind where we can distinguish between virtuous and non-virtuous behavior. So this can be innate. This can come from past lives, this virtuous quality. There are some babies who just don't do bad. Some babies, little children, they're not taught, but they're so compassionate to insects and animals, and they would never harm an animal or insect. They haven't been taught this by their parents. It's innate. It came from past lives. There are other little kids who take pleasure in squashing insects and hurting animals. So they don't have this innate virtue. So this non-confusion is said to be a lucid quality of the mind. It's not the mental factor of knowledge, not yet. But it is a quality of mind which is related to enthusiasm for virtue and a clear mind of concentration. Enthusiasm for virtue is the next virtuous mental factor. So this is a state of delight in virtue, and this is the opponent to laziness. There's information in the notes, you can read that. The eighth is pliancy or suppleness. So actually, this is really only manifest in meditation, when we're approaching single-pointed concentration. The body and mind become pliant. So there's this flexibility in the mind and in the body. We have it a little bit now, but not much. It's really only manifest as we meditate. I remember once, I'd met the lamas, I'd done a course, I hadn't become a Buddhist. Then I was attending the Vipassana retreats with Sri Goenka, a Burmese meditation master, in Benares, and 2 10-day courses in a row, so it was really 20 days. And there you had to sit like for 2 hours and not move. And I remember I had so much pain in my knees and my ankles. And I was determined not to stretch out my legs. And it was to the point where I was literally shaking with pain. And so I told my legs, 10 more breaths and then you can stretch. And as soon as I thought that, the pain went away. So I counted 10 more breaths. And I didn't straighten out. And so the pain came back. So I said, 10 more. Pain went down, but then it came back after 10. And this went on for a while. And then suddenly, I was determined not to move. Suddenly, all the pain totally went. My mind was totally supple, flexible. I couldn't believe it. I thought my legs were about to break. It was just, but it didn't last that long. But that was almost distracting. the dissipation of that, that pain. So I don't know, but I feel because I was really trying to concentrate so hard, I managed to break through into a level of pliancy, this virtuous mental factor of pliancy, where it's described in the teachings on karma abiding. It's physical and mental pliancy or suppleness. So maybe that was a taste. I don't know. Conscientiousness, the next, is a virtuous mental factor which really cherishes the accumulation of virtue. We're conscientious of the need to maintain virtue and cultivate virtue in all actions. Everything is an opportunity for a virtuous response. You see, Lama Tsogyal Rinpoche, like every sentient being is an opportunity to help them. Once we're at Lhasa Rinpoche's cave in the mountains, in the Solukhumbu region, Himalayas, and Rinpoche was leaving to go back down to Kathmandu, and the group decided to go at night time, because if you went down the track, it was a day and a half's walk, it would take so long, because all the Sherpas invite him into their house for a cup of tea, and he gives talks, and it just takes so long. So they decided to go at night, when all the Sherpas were asleep. But the cows, and the insects, and the frogs, and the moths, all the insects and animals were on the path. And Rinpoche, every sentient being, the cows would get mantras and mantras, and then the moths would get mantras and mantras, and it still took much, much longer to get down to the airport at Lukla. So conscientiousness, like Rinpoche is teaching us, Rinpoche doesn't need to accumulate any more virtue. He is a Buddha. But he's showing us that there can be no interruption. There can be no annoying person who's using your time. Every interaction with sentient being is an opportunity to express love, to express wisdom, to teach Dharma, to bless their mind. So conscientiousness. Equanimity is, well, as it holds the mind in virtue. It's very strong and it will not weaken, will not lose the state of virtue. And non-harmfulness is fundamentally is compassion. It is compassion unable to bear the suffering of others. So it's awareness of the suffering of others. And non-harmfulness gives one courage and determination, willingness to help others no matter what problem I might experience in helping others. So we go out of our way, always willing to go out of our way to help others. So that's non-harmfulness. So those are the 11 virtuous mental factors, and they can be manifest like the two, shame and embarrassment and faith. Those three are manifest in every virtuous state of mind. And then the others, non-attachment, non-anger, non-confusion. These can be, some can be more manifest or less manifest, depending upon the situation. So those are the factors that we should train our mind in. And then the root afflictions are the ones to overcome. So the first is attachment. So attachment, hostility, pride, ignorance, deluded doubt, and afflicted views. So pride is a sense of self-importance, of superiority. I'm not going to go into detail, we don't have time, but you can read the notes. Pride is a sense of superiority, and it is a put down of those others that we consider inferior. But the Tibetan word for pride is nga gyel. Nga means I, and gyel means king. I, king. I am super. I am the boss. I am better than you. So there are different types of pride. So at the end of those notes, I think there's a stages. The last section is stages in the development of the afflictions and karmic deeds. Right. So these five stages are important, and we can cover anger and attachment as we go through them. So first of all, everything that appears to our mind, for us ordinary beings, everything appears to exist in a mistaken way, in a way that it doesn't exist. And this is because of the innate imprints of ignorance from past lives. So whenever we think of I or you, you know, somebody else, or objects, one's own self or the self of others appears to our mind to exist in his or her own right, independently, without existing in dependence upon causes and conditions. So this wrong appearance is occurring to our sense consciousnesses and to our mental consciousness. Whatever we experience sensorially, whatever we think about, the object appears wrongly. The second step is that we automatically grasp at that wrong appearance to be true. In terms of our own I, whenever we think of I, we are thinking about the I who exists. But when we think of I, there appears to our mind an I that doesn't exist. Right? An inherent, real, true I, somebody, somewhere within the body and mind. There's this appearance. So our mind just takes that appearance to be true. We don't question it. Mummy appears to exist inherently. We don't question. Mummy is inherently existing. So that is not actually the merely labeled mummy. That is something which doesn't exist. The mother who we think is my mother actually does not exist at all. Nor our father, or our husband, or our wife, or our child, or our possessions. We don't know that there's this wrong appearance. We don't know that we grasp at that to be true. But we live in a false world. The falsity doesn't come from the object. The falsity comes from our mind, the subjective mind. Then, the third step is called inappropriate attention. So we've already said that objects appear, there are pleasant objects and unpleasant objects. And we've already discussed, this is dependent upon the ripening of karma. So when there is a pleasant object, another person or a possession, whatever, a pleasant object is appearing to our mind, it appears as better than it actually is. We superimpose good qualities on the person or the object which aren't actually there. Or we exaggerate good qualities that do exist, but we see them as better than they are. Or on an unpleasant object, we exaggerate the unpleasant qualities bigger than they actually are, and we superimpose non-existent negative qualities on the undesirable objects. So this third step of inappropriate attention That then gives rise to attachment to the exaggerated object of pleasure, or aversion, anger, hatred towards the exaggerated object of displeasure. So this is where attachment and aversion come from. We also, not only from the inappropriate attention, we have the seeds of anger and attachment in our mind from past lives, or from the past of this life. So it's very easy to germinate the seed of attachment every time we experience pleasure. In terms of our relationship, then we see somebody, they appear attractive, and we grasp at that attractiveness as inherently true, and we exaggerate their attractiveness. We see them as indispensable, that this is number one for me, this is the love of my life, this is the person I want to live with. But what we are seeing is a distortion of our own mind. We're not seeing the actual person. We're seeing a super person, much, much better than they actually are. And we cling. We don't want to be separated from them. And we're blinded. In our exaggeration, we blind ourselves to their bad qualities. Well, our friends say, boy, what does she see in him? What does he see in her?
Yeah.
Our friends don't have attachment, they just see the negative qualities. But we can't see them. We deny it. Our friends might say, look, but they're not nice people. They are nice people. I love this person. Nothing wrong. So attachment, aversion arise completely inappropriately, completely out of the context of reality. And this is obscuring our mind. So we might live with the person, and after familiarity, we can't avoid beginning to recognize that they're not as good as we think they are, or that we thought they were. We don't blame ourselves, we blame them for not living up to our projections. So we start to manipulate them and want them to conform to the way we want them to be. And they feel a bit suffocated by our manipulation. They want to bounce back. So we start seeing negative qualities, and then we exaggerate negative qualities. And so our attachment becomes aversion. And the same thing is happening from them to us. They're attached. And we can't fulfill their projections. We feel pressured by their demands for us to conform to their reality. That's not me. Don't ask me to do that. I'm quite happy. I want to do this. I don't want to do that. Arguments. Relationships.
Huh?
We have to see reality. We have to recognize that our problem, the depression, is not coming from the absence of the other person. The depression is a personal letdown of one's inflated, wrong view of reality. It's like Lama Zopa gave this example many years ago, that there are a husband and wife, and the wife thinks great relationship going on very happily, but the husband has been having an affair for a couple of years. She doesn't know. She's content. But then one day the husband leaves, runs off with the woman is having an affair with, and the woman totally depressed, totally collapses. The problem was not the removal of the husband's love. The husband stopped loving her 2 years ago, and she wasn't depressed. It was only when the reality of the breakup broke through her mind that she became depressed. So the depression came from her mind, not from the lack of love from the husband. Relationships are very, very dangerous. That's why I became a monk. I know, I experience it. But still we think, oh no, somebody else, oh they're beautiful, and we go through the whole thing again. Oh, this is the most perfect person. And we again and collapse, you know, the whole story. Okay. So those, and the final step in stages in the development of afflictions is karmic actions. We create karma out of our attachment and aversion. So this has been a brief run through of the mental factors. I'm sure you've heard about it before, but they're so important. They're a real living psychology. They tell us how we can genuinely take control of our lives and how lives can be so much more fruitful, better, and how we can avoid so many mistakes. And this is the gift that Buddha gave to the world, and the gift that our lamas are trying to get across to us. And just before we get there, we have to take responsibility to look after our own mind. And that way, we look after our husband, our wife, our children, our friends, society. That is the way to improve society, is to improve our own mind. So, in other words, you're asking, what the hell are you talking about? I'm just joking. I understand.
Yeah, whether you're telling us that the realms and the cosmology exist in mental states of concentration, or maybe they are real realms.
I see.
Yeah, I'm trying to see this connection with this nature of the mind.
Yeah. Everything does come from our mind. From the Milky Way galaxy to our everyday life is coming from the mind. But it does not mean it doesn't exist. You know, I mean, in general, somebody's really upset and we say, oh, it's all in their mind. Meaning, it's not really happening. Buddhism doesn't say that. It is really happening. Unfortunately. But it still is coming from our mind. But it's still happening. But knowing that it's coming from our mind gives us the understanding that we can do something about it. So this is the 51 mental factors. This is what we can do about it. We can cultivate those virtuous mental factors and abandon the non-virtuous ones. Otherwise, if we, because that is the real cause. We're all, everybody, people in the street, everybody is trying to establish peace and happiness in their minds and the minds of their family and friends, but they're failing. We can't make our spouse happy. We can't stop our spouse from suffering. We can't make our children happy. We can't stop them from suffering. It's so difficult. Our parents, it's so difficult. But we can make our own mind peaceful by understanding this. And in that way, it's merely by example, purely by personal example, our family, friends, society will feel peaceful in our presence. And on top of that, if they're open, we can explain the faults of anger, the faults of attachment, faults of pride, jealousy. If they're open, that writer is there. Not many people are open to understanding this presentation of reality. I felt free to give it as it is because this is a Dharma center. And I really hope that I haven't distorted Buddha's teachings. To the best of my ability, I've tried to convey to you what I have gleaned from Buddha's wisdom in all the years that I've been a monk. I give no guarantee that there's no mistake in what I've said, but I've done my best. So thank you all for being here this weekend. It's always very inspiring to have enthusiasm from people hearing the Dharma. And so we've collectively, as a group, we've accumulated good, positive energy this weekend. So now let's sincerely dedicate this positive energy to others by thinking, may I incorporate this knowledge into my life and act according to what we've discussed and actualize the Dharma in my own mind so that I will be a perfect guide to help others who have been so kind to me in this life and in past lives. Thank you very much.